Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. There is a very exciting event which is going to be occurring at Boswell Books in Milwaukee tomorrow evening. It will be a gathering together of several different authors, one of whom is one of the world's most renowned novelists, responsible for a series known as the Belfast Novels. His name, Stuart Neville. But now we know him for a new book written under the pseudonym or pen name of Hayden Beck, and a book called Here and Gone, set here in America. And I believe it is the first of his novels set here in the United States. And it is a harrowing story in which a woman experiences the greatest nightmare a mother can experience, the disappearance of her own children, and the world, most of the world at least, not believing that they were ever exactly in her care. They are whisked off with no explanation, and she is almost completely alone in trying to find them and secure their release. Again, a terrifying scenario for any mother. And the author, Hayden Beck, has really created a marvelous novel here, and these are a worthy successor to the great novels he has written before this, including The Twelve, Collusion, The Final Silence, Those We Left Behind, So Say the Fallen. Again, this new novel published by Crown is called Here and Gone. And Hayden Beck, Stuart Neville, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. Very glad to be here.
I'm very glad we have this opportunity. Before we start talking about your latest novel, I wonder if you could just say a quick word about how you became a writer in the first place, and what, if anything, in particular, ignited your interest in the written word and you yourself being a writer.
Well, it's something I wanted to do since I was a child, to be honest. I was always a reader from a very young age, and my mother works for the library service, so there are always books coming through the house. And it was just something that took root in me at a very young age. And I tried many times over the years, and I'd maybe write a few pages or something, or maybe a chapter or something, realize it was actually quite hard work, and then set it aside. But it wasn't until, maybe around 12, 13 years ago, I thought, if I'm going to do this, I need to do it now. I'm not getting any younger. So that's when I knuckled down and started making a serious effort. So I wrote a few novels in quite quick succession, and then it was the third of those, which was called The Ghost of Belfast in the United States, and The Twelve in the UK, which became the first book that was published.
You set most of your previous novels in and around Belfast, and you set them during a really important period in the history of Ireland. I mean, fairly recent history, but a period of time that I think maybe to the typical American we might not understand as being particularly remarkable. A period of time which came at the end of something known as the Troubles. Explain this period in your country's history and in a sense what made it such fertile ground for so many novels that you've written.
Well, all of the books, with the exception of one under my own name, Stuart Neville, are set in the present day, or at least the present day when they were written. But the first book, Ghost of Belfast, was written just as the peace process in Northern Ireland had finally taken hold and a government had been established. And it was about the aftermath of the Troubles, which was essentially a very low-level civil war that lasted around 30 years in Northern Ireland from the late 60s up until the late 90s. and many thousands of people died in that conflict. And that first book was very much about the aftermath and how the same people who profited from the conflict were now profiting from the peace, and about the kind of a lot of the hypocrisies and so on that underpinned the peace process. And the first few books dealt with that topic in general, but as Northern Ireland itself normalised, my books moved further and further away from that and became more, for want of a better word, conventional crime novels from there on.
And most of them have surrounded this this woman by the name of Serena Flanagan.
She came along actually in the later books. Her first book she appears in is the Final Silence, but she's become kind of my lead character. I'd always been writing a kind of a loose series, but the thing that connected the books with the setting more so than the character. So it wasn't a series in the sense that, say, Lee Child writes the Jack Reacher series or John Connolly writes the Charlie Parker series. But with Serena Flanagan coming along as a character, it's become more like that. She's become the series lead. Simply because I like her more than the other characters I've written.
So tell us what prompted you to shift your attention as a novelist away from Belfast to a place very, very different from Belfast. In this particular novel, Here and Gone, into a barren rural patch of Arizona. What in particular prompted this shift of focus for you?
Well, the idea itself for the story initially came as a line of dialogue, which, as these things tend to do, popped into my head, seemingly from nowhere. And it was a man saying to a mother, "There's a man will pay me $1 million a child, or $3 million for a pair." And that thing, a line of dialogue, and it startled me for a few days, and I started formulating the story and these characters, and almost straight away, I knew it had to be somewhere with a lot of wilderness and sort of desolate landscapes. A lot of those kind of wide open spaces would be very easy to hide two children. And I'd visited Arizona several times as an author. There's the very famous Poison Pen bookstore in Scottsdale, yeah, in the Phoenix metro area. And so maybe I knew that kind of area. I hadn't traveled much within it, but I'd spent some time there, and I knew the heat and the and that kind of almost alien landscape of the desert. And but then purely by coincidence, I got an email from a guy called John Joseph Doherty at Northern Arizona University in Flagstaff, in the north of the state. And they were studying my first book as part of one of their courses, and wanted to see if I could come and talk to his class if I was in there at the time. So I talked to him. I managed to arrange then a road trip from Scottsdale up to Flagstaff, and I didn't know this at the time, but I know now Flagstaff is at an elevation of something like 7,000 feet, and the landscape completely changes in the north of the state into these pine forests, and it's an entirely different climate. So we did this road trip over a couple of days from the low desert up into the Magellan Rim and the what's called the Colorado Plateau. And back again, we explored all these little back roads and little towns, and I spent the whole time with my little notebook taking notes and taking photographs. And there are all these details then that from that road trip that wind up in the book. Things like the very opening scenes of the novel, there's a little roadside general store, which is based on a real store that we stopped at, and the fictional town of Silverwater is based on an old town we find called Gisella, which is set in this kind of basin between the hills. And so everything on that trip began to inform the book and start to shape things. So it was really just a very fortuitous coincidence that this opportunity came up just as I was thinking we were starting to write the book.
Wow. I'm not actually a bit surprised to hear that you visited Arizona and explored it thoroughly, because that's certainly the sense we have from how vividly you paint the picture, that surely you hadn't just gleaned this from looking at some photographs in a book, but you had sort of soaked in the atmosphere yourself. And In particular, I thought it was interesting that we'll talk about the main characters in a moment, but as they kind of approach this, it's not even so much as a town, but this small little gathering of shacks and buildings, including this little roadside store, that you have the character looking through the window and seeing a place of desperation. That is a place that is, in a sense, desperately poor. And one can imagine that sometimes it is in those kind of places that some terrible things can happen, or people can do some terrible things.
Yeah, I mean, the town is over water in the book. So it's a town that's dying. It had been a wealthy town with local employment provided by the copper mines in the hills around the town, but you know they've been closed down, and anybody who's able to leave is gone, and everybody else is kind of dying along with the town, and it almost becomes a character in the book itself. Even this fictional place, it felt I felt a very good sense of where it was, whose people were, and this kind of slow decline that it was going through.
We're speaking with author Stuart Neville, and under the pen name of Halen Beck, he has written a novel set in the United States in Arizona called Here and Gone. The central character really is a mother by the name of Audra Kinney, and she is, at the time that the novel begins, is on a long trek in her battered station wagon from New York State all the way to California with her two young children, her 11-year-old son, Sean, and her young daughter, Louise, 5 or 6. And she is, in a sense, fleeing one life for what she hopes will be a new life. And Audra Kinney is a complex character, and that's part of what makes her so riveting to us. A complex character to whom we feel great sympathy, even empathy, and yet her life is one that has included some mistakes. Tell us more about her and how you came to create this character and all her complexity.
She kind of needed to have these shadows in her past. So that the antagonists of the book can exploit that for their ends. I mean, she has she's been married to a very wealthy New York businessman, but it was an abusive relationship, and not so much in the sense of that her husband was physically abusive, though he is to an extent. Well, he is emotionally abusive, and there's a kind of spousal abuse that doesn't get actually talked about very much, but it's where one partner feeds the other's addictions and uses it as a means to control them. And in this case, Audra's husband has been kind of keeping her subdued with alcohol and prescription drugs, simply because he's not really that interested in having a wife, but he wants one for appearance's sake. So kind of keeps her locked away and doped up. And she finally struggles her way out of that. And it's told in flashback in the novel, she fights her way out of that. It's a horrendous situation. And basically takes her children and runs. And it's when she's driving across the country in Arizona, she's pulled over by this small-town sheriff. And he arrests her on a trumped-up charge, and a deputy takes the children away. They only stay somewhere safe. Audra is brought back to the small sheriff station, locked in a cell, and she keeps asking, "Where are my children? Where are my children?" Until finally the sheriff says, "What children?"
And those two words are just about as chilling as any two words could be, because it causes her, at least to some extent, to doubt her own sanity. But she, in her heart of hearts, knows that she has two children, and they were in the car, and they were taken away by this other deputy. And from that point on, a desperate search ensues. I want to say that one of the things I also really appreciated is not only the way in which the character of Audra Kinney is painted in such vivid colors, but also her plight of fleeing her old life for what she hopes will be a new life for her and her children in California. And you really help us understand the palpable fear that would surround such a venture. At one point, we read these words. This is very early in the first chapter. For the last few days, Audra had been aware of every law enforcement vehicle she saw. Would they be looking for her? Common sense told her no, they almost certainly weren't. It wasn't like she was a fugitive, was it? But still, that small and terrified part of her brain would not let go of that fear, would not quit telling her they were watching, searching for her, hunting her, even. I think one of the really intriguing things about that passage is it reminds us that the typical person engaged in this frantic trip across country almost certainly wouldn't know for certain whether or not they had done something wrong or done something illegal. And, you know, every law enforcement official that crosses their path, is that someone to be avoided and feared? I mean, is she subject to arrest? And I think many times when this story is told, that facet, that sense of frightening uncertainty is often neglected. I'm glad you don't neglect that as you tell this story.
Thank you. I mean, as the book begins, it's in the first few sentences, I try to get across the sense that, you know, she hasn't planned this flight across this country. It's been a very much a well-known thing, but she's been separated from her husband for, something 6 months. But her husband, being as ruthless as he is using child protection services against her to try and get the kids away from her. So she has fled, but she has this constant fear of being stopped. And, of course, then that particular nightmare comes true.
Hmm. Tell us about crafting the characters of the two children, her son, Sean, and her daughter, Louise. We really fall in love with them, and we feel such concern for them. But I also appreciate the fact that you don't paint them as perfect little caricatures of darling children. Talk a moment about the care you took to craft them in a way that would feel fully authentic.
Well, I knew from very early on that Sean would be a point of view character. What that means is we will have chapters where the world is seen through his eyes and we see his experience of what's going on. But I very much didn't want him to be passive in this. I wanted him to be actively fighting his own battle through the story. And also that allows then the readers to know that this is, even though this awful thing has happened, that there is hope. That there might be a way that between this kid and his mother, they can fight through this. And you know, writing any character, whether it's Sean or whether it's Audra, whether it's Danny Lee, it always comes down to every character, even the villain, even the Sheriff Ronald Whiteside, every character is the hero of their own story within the book. And it's always the approach I take. With any novel and any character, every character has to have a reason to be there and has to have their own fight through the story. And I say that includes villains. Every villain is a hero of their own story as well, so we'll always get those different points of view. And I hope that gives the reader a better understanding where everybody's coming from and what their purpose in the story is. Nobody is just sitting in the background waiting for things to happen to them. They are actively pushing their own.
One facet of this story as it unfolds, as Audra Kinney is taken into custody, her children are taken away, and then she's told what children, is that this story very quickly erupts into the media, and it becomes an account in which the wider world, with almost no exceptions, believes the sheriff, Ronald Whiteside, his account of this, that this strange woman taken into custody continues to believe that she had two children with her, and she does have two children, but they were never in the car when she was arrested, so where are these children? And this story becomes this story of where are these children, but not at all in the way, in fact, that it unfolded. Say a word about the important role that the media plays in how this story spins out, and why you wanted to include that element.
Yeah, I mean, when I thought about this scenario, it seemed obvious to me that it would cause a media storm. And having watched American, particularly American rolling news, is quite different from the news programs where I'm from, you know, to the BBC. In the States, we have these 24-hour news channels. It's kind of everything is milked for all it's worth. And these kind of artificial cliffhangers the newsreaders will use, and they'll come back the next hour for this new revelation, this kind of thing. And it's where news is kind of treated as an entertainment for ratings and so on. So it seemed to me obvious that they would go for a woman like Audra Kinney. They go for the most salacious angles possible. So it felt like just a very natural thing to me. And also then facilitated another aspect of the story, which is a man called Danny Lee, who's in San Francisco, sees these news reports. And it chimes with him because it feels very similar to something that happened to him some years ago. So then he decides his only course of action is to go to Arizona and try and help Audra.
And he is such an intriguing character. He is not what we would immediately think of as the most likely of allies. And the relationship between Audra Kinney and this stranger from San Francisco, who rather abruptly appears on the scene, intrigued by the story and grimly determined to try to help, it is not an easy relationship between the two of them.
No, Danny, I really enjoyed running Danny. Danny is from San Francisco. He's from Chinatown. San Francisco has been a member of the Tong gangs in his past. He's a very murky past himself of violent crime. And so when he kind of enters the story, he gave me a certain freedom that he didn't have to stick by the rules the way any other kind of character might have, because he was sort of kind of from outside the system. He could come in and, shall we say, bypass certain legal channels to try and help things out. And he was a character, I got quite a bit of help with that character from a very good friend of mine called Henry Chang, who's also a crime novelist. He writes crime novels set in New York, Chinatown. He was able to help me a lot with what Danny's world is, the kind of people that he knows and how he interacts with those around him. So, Danny became, a much more interesting and flashback character, largely because of Henry Chang's help. He's kind of, I wouldn't say he's the knight in shining armor. That wouldn't be quite the way to put it. He's a knight with some quite solid armor, shall we say.
Right, absolutely. And that's part of what makes him so such an intriguing character. And he adds a very special sort of spice to this story. We've already touched on the fact that the point of view in the novel changes quite a lot. There will be certain chapters that are told from the perspective or through the eyes of Audra Kinney, the mother, that there are chapters told through the eyes of her son, her 11-year-old son, Sean, other chapters through the eyes of this Danny Lee, and so on. That's certainly not an uncommon choice for an author to make, but I'm really curious to know if there is a specific reason why you chose to craft your book within this kind of framework or format?
It's always been the way I've worked, right from the very first novel. I think largely because of the books that I've read, the books that influenced me, tended to have those multiple points of view. For example, I'm a big fan of James Ellroy. You'll always have three or four characters working through a story. You'll constantly be switching from their points of view. Another influence would be Thomas Harris, who wrote Silence of the Lambs and Red Dragon. And thinking of Red Dragon in particular, was a very big influence for me, because a lot of that book is told from the point of view of the villain, Francis Dolarhyde. And I remember it striking me at the time that even though Francis Dolarhyde is a despicable human being and has done the worst things imaginable, you actually kind of end up rooting for him when you're in his point of view. That's why I've always taken that approach that about several points of view, even the villain, as far as that character is concerned, they're the good guy. And the reader can, to an extent, empathize with even the most horrible people.
Because as they sort of imagine their own personal narrative, they themselves are a noble figure doing noble things, or certainly yeah. what they're doing is at least understandable. And yeah. Whereas from the point of view of the outer world, they would be nothing but a villain, nothing yeah. but a crook. So yes, that gives this book a fascinating sort of texture. Tell us how, in general, you construct your novels beyond this question of the format of the shifting narrative voice, in terms of where do you begin, where do you end, and how do you get from the beginning to the end? And do you create your beginning and your end point first and then fill in the arc between them, or does it emerge in a sense more spontaneously than that?
I always have a beginning and an ending. I always know how the book is going to start and how it's going to end. So I also have this sort of point of departure, a point of destination. But everything between that is kind of up for grabs. I tend to write in a very linear way. I'll start and end at the end. But the story can take several diversions on its way to the conclusion. And I tried doing it otherwise. I tried doing the old sort of index card thing and kind of plot out in detail, but it doesn't really work for me. I find I have to just kind of feel my way through the story, chapter by chapter. And very often things will happen that I wasn't expecting would happen. There'll be specific turns that I didn't know were there until I actually got to that page. But I hope that then when the reader reads it, they get the same sense of surprise that I do writing something.
What about the matter of a story that is, at certain moments in particular, really intense and really unpleasant? I wonder what sort of things cross your mind as you think about including those elements in the story itself, and also how you set about describing those elements and how graphically to describe them. And is there a delicate balancing act between pulling a reader even more deeply into the story and in some cases repelling a reader who just can't go to those places that you intend to take them?
It is. It can be a balancing act. But there's kind of a, as I say, there's kind of a contract between the writer and the reader, and that I'm going to set up these scenarios that's going to pay off. That, you know, when the reader buys the book, there's a promise from me to them that the journey is going to be worthwhile for them, and I'm not going to make them endure anything unendurable, if that makes sense. So, yes, I mean, the premise of the book, when you disappear children, is quite dark, but there's nothing terribly graphic in the book, I should say, and the reader will not come away, after turning the last page, will not come away angry, put it that way.
Right. And I do appreciate the fact that you know, at the heart of this book is, as I said at the outset, every mother's greatest nightmare. And yet you write this book in such a way that, that we don't mind traveling into that and into that nightmare. You, I believe, have already allowed a film option to be signed on this book. That is, there is, I think, the very real possibility that that this book is going to be at some point transferred to the screen. I wonder if you can just say a word about what that feels like as an author, that that something you have created may see a new life, and a new life with which you might be very closely involved, perhaps, or maybe not in very closely involved at all. Is there anything sort of disconcerting along with being exciting about that?
You know, I've learned from experience that if a film option comes along, it's great. You know, you'll get your little bit of money for it, and that's all wonderful, but really then you have to forget about it. I've had my debut novel under my own name, Ghost of Belfast, was optioned by Craig Ferguson, that was at that time was the Late Show host. I was very, very excited at the time, but as tends to happen with these things, that it just didn't come around. You know, they couldn't get the project off the ground. And as a writer, that's you've got to be wary of. You know, for every 100 books that are optioned, maybe one might get as far as being made into a movie. So really, you just have to sign your contract and then put it out of your mind, because there's nothing I can do to get it, help it get made. And it's such a mountain to climb to get a movie made. Even on a low budget, there's so many planets that have to align to get that project on its feet that, you know, if you're sitting waiting for that moment to come when the cameras roll, you could be waiting a long time. But at the same time, you know, it's Random House Films, and it's James Sheamus has this in development. I know they're going to give it a good shot. If it happens, it's brilliant. If it doesn't happen, you know, I can't. Nothing I can do about it. Basically, honestly, it's nothing to do with me. Basically, is the short answer to that.
Right. How likely is it that you are going to be writing more novels set here in the United States, and how do you intend to, if you're going to explore more of these kind of stories, how do you suspect or expect you will balance American work with your Belfast work, so to speak?
Well, I'm just finishing another novel at the minute under the name of Hailing Back, this time set in New York. So I'm literally just writing the very last pages of that book right now. And the plan is it's revolving between one and the other, so there'll be a Hailing Back book and a Stuart Neville book. If I can, I'll be writing one of each a year. That might be too big an ask. But I mean, I have a readership as Stuart Neville, and it's quite a dedicated readership, which I'm very grateful for. And I want to continue to serve them as well as do these American set books. And you know, both, you know, the Belfast set books and the Serena Flanagan books are very close to my heart. So I'm not going to abandon those. But at the same time, I enjoy the change of scenery. I'm just moving the story to America. So I'd like to be able to just keep doing both if I can.
Well, we certainly hope that can be possible. Your previous novels have all been so highly acclaimed, and this most recent novel, absolutely stunning, and I hope many people will seek it out, and I hope many people intrigued by this novel and intrigued by our conversation will take advantage of meeting you and a couple of your colleagues and counterparts at an event tomorrow night at Boswell Books. That's at 2559 Downer in Milwaukee, an event, a free event, which begins at 7 p.m. We've been talking about the novel Here and Gone under the pen name of Halen Beck, its author, Stuart Neville. Mr. Neville, it's been a great honor for me to speak with you. I am a great admirer of your work and loved this novel, and wish you well with all of your future writing.
Thank you very much indeed.
And the time is 8:45. You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. And in part two of today's program, you're going to hear an excerpt from my conversation with Barbara Mitchell and Cornelia Gamlin, the co-authors of a very interesting book called The Big Book of HR. And, of course, the letters HR refer to human resources. And typically, that is the department of a company and which deals with problems when they come up related to employees, whether the employee has a complaint of some kind or employee must be terminated or any other such unpleasantries that so often come up in modern workplaces. But the world of HR is a lot bigger than that. And to do the work of an HR specialist well requires an attention to all kinds of different things. And all of that is explored in this book published by Career Press, again, called The Big Book of HR. Interesting examination of this. Here's a portion of our conversation. I appreciated that your book right off the bat kind of gives us a bigger view of what it means to be interested in HR. And among the many bits of advice given in the book is the notion that when someone works in HR, it really makes sense to know everything you can possibly know about every other facet of the company. That in other words, to keep yourself in your own little tidy silo really does yourself a disservice and really probably undermines the work that you might want to do as an HR specialist. Just say a word about the other kinds of things beyond the obvious that an HR employee needs to think about.
Well, you know, one of the things that so often gets lost is realizing that you've got to know a lot about the business that you're in, because in order to be effective, you have to understand what it is that the organization does. You know, if you're recruiting, you have to understand what all the different functions are that you're recruiting for, and, you know, that's a tremendous way to learn so much about the business. But also if you're dealing with other issues, you know, around compensating employees or motivating employees, it's important that, you know, you recognize that different managers within the organization may do things different ways, and you want to try to bring a lot of that together. You know, I think for any strong individual within an organization, whether it's within HR or within any of the other functions, if you're managing, you've got to realize, you know, what the other functions do and how they all contribute to the organization.
It was interesting in this very first chapter, this introductory chapter, that you spent a few moments talking about the various generations and the fact that it's possible, although maybe not all that likely, but it's conceivable that among your base of employees, you might have people from five different generations within the same four walls working at the same place. And there are some intriguing differences, at the risk of making generalizations, but some intriguing differences between the various generations in terms of how people prefer to function in the workplace. Say a word about why you thought it was important to take time with this matter of the various generations.
Well, it's extremely important for people to understand each other and be able to work with people, even if they are from a different generation. And one of the things we hope we focus attention on is not so much the differences between the generations, but the similarities and how people can complement each other. For example, having millennials reverse mentor a baby boomer in technology, so that you're sharing expertise, but you're also learning about each other, and the baby boomer can perhaps share some knowledge about the organization that the millennial might not have. So we just think it's important for people to understand the different generations, but not focus on the differences. Focus on how we can all work together and complement each other.
You take some time to talk about globalization. Why is the matter of globalization so significant when we're talking about something like HR?
Well,
for an HR professional, if you suddenly find that your organization is doing business in another country, that there are a lot of implications, you know, trying to find the best way to hire people, understanding some of the nuances of the laws that exist in varying countries. You know, in many of the European countries, it's very difficult to terminate somebody if they've got a lot of people are on employment contracts. So you've got to recognize that it's not always business as usual from the way we may do things in the U.S. There are a lot of other different forces. There's a lot of the cultural forces that are at play that you've also got to recognize that. Business is just conducted in different ways in different cultures, and you've got to have an understanding and respect for some of those cultures if the organization is going to succeed in different parts of the world.
We're speaking with Barbara Mitchell and Cornelia Gamlam, co-authors of a book called The Big Book of HR, which has just been published in an expanded edition, and it really explores just about every conceivable facet of what it means to work in the arena of HR. And it's interesting, in a book like this, some of what we see is relatively straightforward and might be concepts that we're already acquainted with, and then others might not be, including certain terms that where the words might all make sense or be commonplace, but then we realize that they are put together in a way and mean something that a lot of us are not aware of at all. For instance, you take a bit of time in the book early on to talk about something called workforce planning. And it sounds, in a sense, relatively mundane, but my word, it's very, very important, and also probably something that too many companies don't bother to do. What do you mean by workforce planning?
Workforce planning is an integral part of the whole strategic planning process for an organization. Having the right people in the right places is just so key to any organization's success. So workforce planning is looking at where the organization is headed. Are they going to grow? Are they going to downsize? Are they going to expand into new markets? Are they going to go international? All of these things then need to be factored in to what kind of people do we need? Does our current workforce meet those needs? And if not, where do we get the people to fit those needs? So workforce planning is extremely important, and you're right. Many organizations overlook it and then perhaps get caught flat-footed, not having the right people.
There are a couple of different chapters in the book in which the titles begin with the words, the legal landscape of. For instance, the legal landscape of employee rights, or the legal landscape of compensation, and I believe there's at least one more. Those are really kind of intimidating words, and it makes us realize that that's one reality that anybody who wants to work in HR has to come to grips with, is that there is a intricate and sometimes really complicated, maybe even once in a while convoluted, set of laws that one must be aware of in order to navigate these waters. Can you say a word about that particular challenge and how someone working in HR can hope to contend with those challenges?
Certainly, and you're right. It really is a very big challenge, particularly for a smaller organization. Whether you're in HR or whether you're a manager or a small business owner, you've got to at least have some level of understanding of what all of these different laws are that touch the different parts of managing people. You know, we devoted a whole chapter early on the legal landscape of employee rights that deals with, you know, topics such as discrimination of employees. And it's important to recognize, without diving very deep into a lot of it, because sometimes these situations can get very complex, and that's where you need to bring in some legal expertise. And we kind of make that clear, too, but by letting people know that, situations occur that really need to be handled delicately. But if you have at least a baseline understanding of some of the legal areas that you may be kind of walking through as you're trying to manage some of these situations, it gives you that sense of, okay, I understand this, but maybe I need to, you know, to bring in some more help. But, you know, you had asked about, you know, how do you stay on top of a lot of these things? And it can be, that could really be a challenge unless you're specialized in one particular area of human resources. Then you may have the luxury of just saying, okay, I'm just going to focus on, you know, some of the discrimination law or some of what's going on in compensation and let some of my colleagues deal with some of the other areas. But you know, I think that the best information that I can give or the best advice I can give to people is there's a wealth of information on a lot of the government websites. So if you need to look something up, if you want to know more about it, you know, that would be the first place to turn to. But, you know, don't ever discount the need to get some legal help and make sure you've got a good employment attorney that can help you with some of these issues.
I really enjoyed the chapter titled Job Descriptions because I think that's the kind of thing that at a glance seems relatively mundane and also probably an exercise in the obvious. And, of course, it's anything but that. I mean, in terms of, first of all, the importance of putting together what is really a truthful and helpful job description for the sake of those who might be applying for such a position, and how the process of putting that together can be so helpful for you on your end, even before it comes time to actually make decisions about who to hire. Just say a quick word about how important a good job description is and what needs to be part of it.
First, let me say nobody has ever told us that they enjoyed that chapter in the book. So you are just, we love hearing that. So thanks, Greg. Job descriptions are extremely important and help in so many ways. First of all, getting a handle on what the person is going to do. And most organizations, people just maybe have a job description that was written 5 years ago and they just keep using it over and over, but the job has totally changed. So we recommend that each time a job is filled, that and job descriptions are looked at, or even more often than that, because they're used for so many things. They're used for accountability. What did we say this job was required, and is the incumbent doing what they were told to do or asked to do? They're used for compensation. They're used for hiring, certainly. And they can be used in other ways as well for measuring performance. So job descriptions are extremely important, and they can be an interesting process. They can be tedious, but the payoff is huge.
One of the interesting points made in your sixth chapter on figuring out your hiring criteria is that it is important that an employee is hired for culture. Hired for the culture of the company. How are you using the term culture in this particular context? And why is hiring for culture so crucial to whether or not an employee and their company are going to be a good match?
Your culture is how you manage, how your organization communicates. What are your values? What's your vision? We talk to many people who tell us their organization doesn't have a culture, and we kind of chuckle and say, yes, it does. You may not be aware of it, but every organization has a culture. And you want to have employees that will come in and be able to thrive in that culture, who will be the kind of people who will grow and learn and be able to handle your culture. Your culture may be a place where people are expected to work long hours, and perhaps that person doesn't want to do that. So upfront, knowing your culture, hiring for your culture, that's how you get people engaged and how you keep them, as well as when you hire the right people.
Barbara Mitchell and Cornelia Gamlin are the co-authors of The Big Book of HR.